Welcome to Listen to Older Voices, a program produced for Uniting Melba and podcast through the Toorak Times. It's always a pleasure to bring you, through their stories, the life and times of older people in our community. All very interesting, all very different, and all very entertaining. Hi, I'm Rob Greaves and this is part one of a three-part program featuring the life and times of war baby Murray Robertson. Murray's mother was a classical pianist and, being brought up in a home with a grand piano, he was encouraged to play from a very early age. His father, born in 1890, fought in World War I and came back injured with the loss of one eye as a result of shrapnel. As Murray comments, a centimetre or so closer to the brain, and he, Murray, may never have been. Although growing up as a teen in the 1950s, when rock and roll was rearing its head, Murray was more involved in playing classical piano, and in fact undertook the Australian Music Board exams for 7 years. However, we also learn how the music of the big band era drew him away from classical piano and put him on the road to his first band, the legendary Thunderbirds. Yet, having not thought about music as a full-time career, Murray undertakes a 5-year apprenticeship in aircraft electrical engineering, which he completes. There's much more to tell in this first part of his story, so let's make a start. Here I am, speaking with Murray. Murray, first of all, thank you for inviting me into your home.
It's a pleasure, Rob.
Could I start by asking you, what year were you born in?
1940.
So you're not actually a baby boomer, you're a war baby then?
Yes.
Well, looking at that, whereabouts were you born?
I was born in Moreland Road, Moreland, in Melbourne, suburb of Melbourne.
That would have been significantly different then to as it is now.
Oh, very much so. I don't remember a lot of it, but it's a lot busier with a lot more people around now, of course. Vaucluse Hospital it was.
Thinking back at that time, what would be some of your early memories as a child then?
I spent a year in one house with my parents and then moved after when I was 1 year old to Prendergast Street, Pascoe South. And that was on top of a hill in that area. It was just close to Moreland Road still, called Coonan's Hill. Mm-hmm. And I remember there was a kindergarten nearby. And one of the pictures of that kindergarten was at a time when they had 5 sets of twins attending that kindergarten at the one time.
A bit of chaos.
Yeah. The main thing I remember about my childhood growing up was neighbourhood kids and playing football and cricket in the street.
It was a very social thing, wasn't it, being a kid in those days? And yeah, outdoors.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
Everything was outdoors.
Except when I had to do my piano practice, when I looked out the window and watching the other kids playing cricket in the street and I was practicing.
So was that mum or dad that sort of pushed you into that?
I wouldn't say pushed was the right word, but my mother was a classical pianist. And both my mother and father were singers, sang in choirs, and my mother played organ at the St. John's Anglican Church in West Brunswick for a long time.
So you were really embracing the music, even at that age?
More or less. It was something that was just automatic. I grew up with a grand piano in our lounge room. So.
Wow. Okay, that's not something many kids do. Now, were you allowed to play on it?
All the time.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I was encouraged to play it.
Right.
But you can't force this thing upon children, I don't think.
No.
I did it naturally, anyway.
What sort of person was your mum?
Oh, very quiet, reserved. They were religious people, my mother and father. Not extremely social, but I think that was more or less to do with the way they were growing up. My mother had a fairly reserved or sometimes traumatic life. She told me once she watched her brother, who was trying to retrieve a cockatoo that had escaped somewhere, fell out of a tree and broke his neck. And that was one of her brother. And she was estranged from her parents, moved from Sydney to Melbourne in her early life. But my mother and father were the result or victims of the First World War. My father was enlisted in the First World War when he was 24, and he was born in 1890, my father.
Wow.
He was 24, and he served in the Middle East and France. He was in Pozieres in France in the trenches when he collected a piece of German shrapnel in his head and took out one of his eyes.
Oh.
So I'm probably a centimetres from existence.
Yes.
Because if it had been anything closer to his head or brain, I mightn't be here, or I wouldn't be here. But he spent 6 months in a hospital in England and was nursed by the nurse, and he corresponded with her through his entire life after that.
Because he had that sort of connection.
Oh, well, it was then.
Yeah, yeah. So when he returned home, as far as you can recollect, do you think he was a changed man from that experience?
One thing that I know, that apart from some references to kids begging in the streets in the Middle East, he made no reference to his war experience at all.
No, and that's not unusual, is it? The parents whether
he,
never did.
Whether he carried trauma because of it, I don't know.
Mm.
But he was very reserved.
Yeah.
But you have to remember, he was 50 years old when I was born.
Well, I was going to make mention of that because that's pretty unusual.
There were 11 years difference between my mother and my father. She was 39 and he was 50 years old. And after five miscarriages, I was born.
Wow, they really tried hard.
And then 3 years later, she had twins. So my brother and sister are twins.
Do you think having a father that old made a difference to you growing up?
Well, I don't know, because the experience of having a younger father, he was very reserved.
Right.
Not highly social, though their lives were involved with the local Presbyterian church, and I grew up in that environment.
All right, well, let's move out of the house back out into that street that you talked about with the kids.
Yeah, yeah, there was a lot of kids in the area, and they all enjoyed competition and exercise and, you know, the social business of playing in the street, yeah.
Did you go to the things like the pictures and things like that at that age?
Yes.
Because Saturday afternoon, matinees.
The Western Theatre in Melville Road, Brunswick, showed the American Westerns in matinees on Saturday afternoon. I remember going there, yes.
Yeah.
And that was a tram ride from my place down Melville Road.
Right.
Yeah, we used to, I suppose, 15-minute walk to the tram from my house.
And never thought any bad thing about it in those days, did you?
Sort of no.
Ranging fairly wide and far.
I grew up without a motor car in the family at all.
Wow.
Neither my mother nor my father. Well, my father couldn't, having only one eye, but my mother never drove a car, never owned a car. My father never owned a car.
Right. What about school? What was your early school experiences like?
Yeah, I went to Northwest Brunswick Primary School, which was, again, walking distance from our house. And my secondary school up to 50 year was Moreland High School, which was a bike ride down Moreland Road from between Melville Road and Sydney Road and up Sydney Road a little and to the school. And I rode to school and back every day for 5 years, or every school day for 5 years.
And never thought anything about it?
No.
No.
Gave me strong legs, I think.
Yes. Was your school experience a good one?
Yes. Very sport-oriented, which I was in high school.
Right.
I played football in the school team and mostly in athletics,
mm-hmm.
running and jumping, high jump.
Right.
And running. But it didn't continue after that.
I'd like to talk to you a little bit later on about what happened when you left school. But before we do that, given you were born in 1940, there would be no television. So did radio play an important part of your life growing up?
Yes. Yeah, I remember the Biggle series on radio. And
of course.
I can't say that I went out of my way to listen to radio continually, but those sort of things I remember.
The other thing about you being a teenager in your middle teen years, 15, 16, 17 years of age, that corresponds beautifully with the more development of rock and roll in the States.
Oh.
When and how did that have an effect on you? Because it obviously did.
Well, my musical education was classical because I had a teacher for 7 years, did the Australian Music Board exams for 7 years, But then things changed dramatically. I didn't take to it all that well. It always amazes me something about my mother who could read two-handed classical piano like you read the newspaper. And it amazed me how she could do that escaped me completely.
You didn't get that genetic side?
No, it's not something that I excelled at all. And mainly because I wasn't meant to. I think so.
Yes.
Because in my early teens, I was subject to, if you could put that, two films. One was the Glenn Miller story, and then there was Benny Goodman's story. And these two films introduced me to big band swing music and rhythm, as opposed to what classical music is. And that was it for me. Yeah, and I've loved it ever since.
And this is Listen to Older Voices, Ageless Stories on Ageless Radio. I'm Rob Greaves and I'm talking with Murray Robertson. And Murray is talking about the influences that drew him away from classical piano to a more popular style.
So do you recall your early attempts to transfer across from classical to playing a more swing type music on your piano?
It just happened automatically.
How did Mum cope with that?
I'm not sure. To this day, I'm not sure. I think she was just sort of a bit stoic and sort of said, oh, well, if it's going to be, it's going to be. And this is the modern music. I mean, she was hearing this sort of stuff because this is early 50s.
Mm.
Out of that came the development of what we now know as rock and roll.
Of course, that's right.
And I heard that, although at a distance, because it didn't happen in Australia, it happened in America.
Yes.
The evolution of, and the melding of blues, country music in America, and the Latin influences are also part of it. Most of it, I believe, came from New Orleans. I believe the heart of the development of modern music in America came from New Orleans. In fact, everything that you hear now is a development of that.
Well, you had such great people, didn't you?
It was a melting pot of French influence, Latin American influence, American mountain country music. And it all melted together and produced blues. It went from New Orleans to Chicago to New York, and that's when the jazz influence, Louis Armstrong and people of his style and genre.
So how did a boy in Melbourne with this classical upbringing and training actually, you mentioned the films, but how did you learn and get your influences from? Because as you mentioned, it was all happening over there, not here.
Just listening and hearing it. Because it was all played here, radio, recordings, vinyl at that stage.
Yeah, absolutely.
And stuff that was played on radio here, because this is like an avalanche, this movement from the traditional American to the rock and roll. It was like an avalanche.
Yes.
And it was so dominating here in Australia because it all came. I can remember later on when my involvement with the band I joined and my getting to know a man called Stan Rofe, who became a very good friend, sitting at the 3XY radio station at the Trades Hall Council with piles and piles of 7-inch 45 recordings from America, going through them, looking at their titles, who wrote them, who are performing them, and sifting them out and listening. And when you hear stuff like that, it has effect on you. You know, you begin to listen, and because of the classical training, which involved, you know, melody and harmony and rhythm to a certain extent, you sense what you hear and how it's developing and how you respond to it. And that became the major impact on my life musically.
So that's quite a strong learning experience, wasn't it, for you? And one that not many other people would have had the opportunity because of that connection with Stan Rolfe.
That happened into the experience I had because I think I was 17. It would have been in 1957. Because this is in conjunction with me at what age would I have been? 16, the year before, starting an apprenticeship in the aircraft industry at Essendon Airport in Melbourne, which was then the major airport in Melbourne. I was interested in aircraft, and my father said, well, why don't you try this? And I applied for it and started. It was then 5-year apprenticeship in aircraft electrical stuff. And we were dealing with piston engine aircraft then.
Yes. How long did you last in the apprenticeship?
I did the 5 years.
You did the 5 years?
And I moved from working in the, not a factory, in the workshop where the componentry of the aircraft was overhauled and repaired and re-registered as being serviceable for future use. I moved from that into drafting in an instrument company which was an affiliate of the Ansett.
Right.
Airways group.
So it looked like, for all intents and purposes, that was going to be a lifelong career at that point.
Well, it was. The drafting aspect of it developed into a lifelong career for me in association with the music. They travelled together.
And this is Listen to Older Voices, a program that presents the stories of everyday Australians through the recollection of their lives.
So how did the music start? You mentioned a first band.
I went to a social event in Strathmore, Essendon, and met a young guy at the time called Harold Frith, and he was a drummer. And he was already playing in a band with a group of people. One was a sax player, and I think he had a woman, the names I can't remember, playing piano with him. But he was a go-getter. He wanted to do a lot more than he was doing then, and we talked about it, and I told him I played piano, and we talked about influences. So the end result with that is that I joined a band that he played in. I do remember the guitar player's name was Mickey Borg. I think he was a Maltese extraction, his parents were from Malta. The other people, I can't remember who they were, but. And then other members joined. We had a sax player and guitar player and bass player. Peter Robinson joined the band as a bass player, playing upright bass. He met Harold Frith on a train, and we just started playing around the local area, Moonee Ponds, Maribyrnong, Essendon, and then expanded from there, because the musical ability of guys that Harold selected for the band was not rock and roll based, it was jazz based.
We're in the early 60s or still late 50s here?
Late 50, 57.
So Harold was really very astute about who he chose.
I would say so. He was a smart fella.
Right. What was the name of the band at this stage?
The Thunderbirds.
It was the Thunderbirds,
yes.
Who were quite an iconic band.
Yes. One of the major music influences, as it turned out, in Melbourne for 6 years.
Both in their own right in terms of playing their own music and also supporting other artists, didn't they? Well, recordings.
That was, as it turned out, the main development of the band. I mean, because of the jazz and swing influence, the Thunderbirds as a band played a lot of instrumentals, mm-hmm. a lot of just music instrumentals. But because they were able, a lot of their work, and people were attracted to come and work at places where the Thunderbirds were playing. Because we could play material for singers and quickly and do it quite well too. So a lot of the people who developed around Melbourne did in conjunction with the Thunderbirds, people like Betty McQuaid, Marcy.
Yes.
My partner Marcy Jones. And we had a singer named Billy Owens and Billy O'Rourke. These were singers that performed in the dance scene around Melbourne, which was hugely popular. And it cements a theory that I have that all the major developments in music, and most of it came out of America, this stuff, is associated with dance.
Mm-hmm.
That's why we don't have very much going at the moment. I mean, I don't have much time for it, actually, but... This is mainly because of my upbringing and what my influences were, listening to people like Oscar Peterson and Gene Krupa and Benny Goodman and all the musicians that were around that era.
Who were musicians, weren't they? They weren't just music makers, they were musicians, they were artists, yes. They were
Louis Armstrong, yes. I've read a lot about Louis Armstrong and his influences and who he influenced and...
You mentioned the fact that the dance scene and the music scene in Melbourne was highly popular in that period. Is it true that it was mostly town hall based and local hall based?
Yeah, large halls that could fit a lot of people and where they could dance, and that's what they did. The Canterbury Ballroom was where Marcia first auditioned with the Thunderbirds, was a converted cinema, I think. But there were town halls, Preston Town Hall, Coburg Town Hall. Mm-hmm. Was it Q? Q mm-hmm. Town Hall?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they were big halls.
Do you look back at those times and those events fondly?
Oh, yeah. Yes, certainly. Earl's Court was another major venue that the Thunderbirds played in, and even in today's scene, we played at Earl's Court 5 times a week.
That was a lot.
For 6 months or more. It was Thursday night, Friday night, Saturday night, Sunday afternoon and Sunday night in the 1 week, every week. Saturday night there were 1,200 kids in that place. And it got so popular that visiting bands who performed at Festival Hall in Melbourne would come after their gig to Earl's Court to jam and play.
That would have been something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's how popular it was.
These... dances were obviously very well organised.
Yes.
We're also talking about a period in the 50s and in moving into the 60s when there was a little, what we might call, disruption. There were the rockers and the jazzers and a little bit later on other sort of things. Did you ever have much trouble at the dances?
Well, we didn't have much trouble, but there was trouble on the dance floor from time to time, yes.
Right.
These rockers and jazzers, as you referred to them, was more about how they perceived the dancing to be carried out rather than anything else. And it became a social line that was drawn between that sort of influence. But it didn't mean much, I don't think. I mean, the trouble was physical more than anything and probably fueled with alcohol.
Of course.
Although that wasn't a major... problem, not from what I perceived anyway, but I was doing other stuff at the time, so...
Well, you mentioned to us just then about the enormous amount of gigs you were doing per week. How the heck were you able to work a full-time job as well? Because that must have been just a terrific pressure.
Yeah, with rehearsal and, I mean, this supporting the band did of all these vocalists didn't just happen on the stage at the time. We had to rehearse with them and practice with them, but I managed.
You did, yes, obviously. Yeah. Did it ever get to the stage where you thought you might have to give up the day job? Or?
Well, I did for 6 months.
When was that?
1960.
What happened to create that situation?
The Thunderbirds were given the job to play for a visiting touring group of American performers. And this was unprecedented. It had never been done before. By a small, we were a five-piece rock band. That's what they called it anyway, a group of five musicians.
Can you recall who made up the American tour?
Yeah, I know very well who did it.
You want to share it with us?
Yeah, Roy Orbison, Jack Scott, Dion DiMucci.
Yes.
And Ray Peterson.
Oh, okay.
There was another one who was, when we first learnt about this job, Freddie Cannon was supposed to come, but for whatever reason, he didn't come. So it was just the others.
Join Murray and I next week when we learn of the incredible success he had with the Thunderbirds, including touring with an amazing lineup of American rock and roll stars in a national tour, while still maintaining a career in the aircraft and other industries. Next week, Murray Robertson on Listen to Older Voices. Listen to Older Voices is produced by Rob Greaves at the Melbourne Community Support Program on behalf of Wesley Mission Victoria. The program is supported by financial assistance from the Commonwealth Government through the Commonwealth Home Support Program and is brought to you through the Toorak Times.